All right, we're going to be looking at Revelation chapter 21. As we've been going through the book, we've said many times that this book is difficult to understand, but not impossible to understand. And so as we're trying to understand it, there's a couple things we have to keep in mind. The first point is we have to remember the style of the book. It's a book of signs and symbols. It's a book of images, and the message is in the images. It's not about the actual image itself, but it's about what those images represent. And then second, we have to remember the time frame. This was written for the Christians of the first century. So as we're looking at this, we have to understand that these images are going to be things that would pertain to those people of the first century. They're not going to be things that were happening in the 20th century or the 21st century. The vision that we're going to look at today has two different interpretations, and both of those interpretations would have applicability to the first century church. One interpretation is that this New Jerusalem is the church on earth that is going to go into a new phase after the persecution is over. And the second one is that this New Jerusalem is going to be heaven itself. Both of those interpretations have some merit, but I lean towards the one about heaven itself, and so we'll be explaining that as we go on. Heaven is the final phase of the church. We are destined to go to heaven. That's the whole reason that God gave us the church, that we could teach each other what it is that we're supposed to know so that we can go to heaven. And so as it talks about the church, it could be talking about it in the sense that the church is going to be in heaven. So I think that's one way we can look at this as we go through this. If we were to look at the New Jerusalem being the church after that phase of persecution, it would fit closer with the time frame, because verse 1 told us these are things that would shortly take place. But as we've been going through these chapters, we've already come to a shift in the time frame. We were looking at the end of chapter 20. We saw there that John started to see some future events, and specifically, it was looking at the day of judgment. We saw that Satan was overthrown, and he was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. That was chapter 20 and verse 10. We also saw the great white throne, and everyone was standing around that throne, and they were going to be judged on the works that they had done. So that is the judgment day. It told us there, anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. And that will be the eternal destiny of all sinners. Chapter 21 seems to continue that same time frame because John sees his vision after the first earth and the first heaven had passed away. And so that's one of the main reasons I think this is a vision of heaven, because it's giving us that time frame. The time frame is after the judgment day. So in the previous chapters, we'd seen God bringing judgment upon the wicked. Now in these last two chapters of the book, we're going to see the destiny of the righteous. The focus is going to shift about what is going to happen to these saints who are receiving this message, that are suffering, that are being persecuted, that are being killed. So this is going to be a message that would bring comfort to them, that there is a much better place coming for them. In chapter 21, we're going to look at two different aspects of heaven. When we go to heaven, we're going to be in fellowship with God, and God is going to protect us from all harm. The first eight verses that we're going to look at are going to describe this fellowship that we have with God in heaven. This is going to be much closer than the fellowship that we have right now on earth. Such a close fellowship that I don't see this as just a shift in what's happening to the church, going from a period of persecution to a period of rest and peace. This is going to be a much, much closer fellowship than we will ever have on earth. And that's another reason, again, think that this is talking about heaven itself. So let's get into the verses. We've got 27 verses to cover, so there's not going to be a whole lot of discussion on any one of the verses. We'll have a little bit more in the beginning here as we're talking about the different interpretations. So verse 1 says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea." So here we see John describes a new heaven and a new earth. So it's not just about fixing up the old earth. The old earth is going to pass away and we are going to have a brand new earth. And again, this fits that time frame of being after the day of judgment. Earth is going to pass away. It's going to melt with a fervent heat. After that, we're going to be in a different state. We're going to be in heaven, and it's described figuratively here as a new heaven and a new earth. The Jehovah's Witnesses will tell us that the fire that's going to come is just going to cleanse the earth, and it's going to take out all of that sin and all of the problems, and then the earth is going to exist. But as we're looking here, we see it's going to be something much more than that, because it says that earth and the heavens have passed away. Now, this is a book of signs and symbols. So you could look at this and you could say, well, when it says it's going to pass away, that's just symbolic. It's really going to be cleansed, like the Jehovah's Witnesses say. Well, we've got other places that talk about this same event that are non-figurative. So we can go to them and we can see what those non-figurative books tell us. And I want to look at 2 Peter chapter 3, and we'll start at verse 7. 2 Peter 3, 7. "But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." So we see it's going to be burned up by fire. And dropping down in verse 10, it tells us this a little clearer. Verse 10, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with a fervent heat." So John's vision is the same thing that Peter told us in his epistle. The earth is going to pass away. It's going to be burned up. It's not going to exist anymore. When the day of judgment comes, the earth is going to be gone. So in its place, we have a new heaven and a new earth. And this is figurative language again. I think what it is describing for us here, it is heaven. And as we read this description, we are going to see just how much it is different from what we have right now. At the end of verse 1, it says, "There was no more sea." And again, there's a couple interpretations to that. We saw the sea of glass in chapter 4 and verse 6, and it was also at chapter 15 and verse 2. And we describe that as a separator that separated the physical world from the spiritual world. We also talked about it being a barrier between the people of God on earth and God who was in heaven. At the end of the world, that separator is going to be gone. That's going to be taken away. Those who are righteous are going to be taken up to heaven. Those who have been wicked are going to be cast into the lake of fire. That separator is no longer needed. We also saw a second definition. We saw that the sea could refer to that mass of humanity. We saw in Revelation 13:1 that the beast rose out of the sea, and we talked about that sea being that mass of humanity, those who are persecuting the Christians. Well, when we get to the end of the world, the day of judgment, those who are wicked, those who are persecuting these Christians are going to be cast into the lake of fire. So they're not going to be there anymore. That multitude, that sea of humanity is going to be gone. So that might be another way of looking at this. In verse 2, it says, "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." So in verse 2, John sees this city coming down out of heaven. This city that we're looking forward to has been described several times already. We've seen it here in this book. It's also been described in the book of Hebrews. The Hebrew writer at Hebrews 11 and verse 10, as he spoke of Abraham, said Abraham was waiting for the city whose builder and maker is God. That fits this new Jerusalem that we're seeing. In Hebrews 11:16, speaking of the faithful descendants of Abraham, the Hebrew writer said that God has prepared a city for them. Again, this new Jerusalem. In Hebrews 12, verses 22 and 23, the Hebrew writer said, "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven." So again, it's talking about this new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem. In this last verse, it also says the church is going to be there. John saw this new city come down out of heaven. We saw in Revelation 3 and verse 2, as Jesus was talking to the church at Philadelphia, Jesus said, "I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God." And that's what John is seeing now in this present vision. Those who believe that the new Jerusalem represents a church come to this verse, and they use this verse. It says this new Jerusalem is coming out of heaven, so they say it can't really be talking about heaven itself. It's talking about something that came out of heaven. Also, the city is compared to a bride adorned for her husband. When we talk about the bride of Christ, what do we think of? We think of the church. So this is talking about the church. But the church also could be looked at in its final glorious state as those who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb enter into heaven to be with God for all of eternity. So it is still talking about the church, I believe, but in a different way. Not talking about the church on earth, it's talking about the reward that is waiting for all of the faithful. Those who are faithful in the church are going to be in heaven. It is described as something coming down out of heaven, but this is figurative. Maybe John is just being allowed to see a part of heaven. So maybe that's why it's talking about him coming down. So again, this is figurative language. We don't have to really tie every specific thing to some fact. It's giving us an image of what heaven is going to be like. All right, let's look at verses 3 and 4. All right, verse 3. "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God." So in verse 3, John hears this loud voice from heaven. The voice is not identified, but it probably is an angel because it's referring to God in the third person. God would talk about himself with pronouns like I. So this sounds like it's talking about him from an angel's perspective. And it's talking about God's tabernacle, which is the place where God dwells. We saw in the Old Testament that God would come down, a cloud would cover the tabernacle, and that would be a sign that God's presence had come into the tabernacle. We saw it also when the temple was dedicated, that God's presence filled the temple. And so this is an indication that God is here in this new Jerusalem. He is there present with them. So as it describes the tabernacle, it's really just talking about this being the dwelling place of God. And again, these are going to be words of comfort for those who are suffering at this time. After their suffering is over, they are going to be in the presence of God. They are going to dwell directly with God. Verse 4, "And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." So verse 4 gives us some of the ways that heaven is going to be so much better than what we have living here on the earth. God is going to wipe away every tear from our eyes. And that means that there's going to be nothing in heaven that's going to cause us any sadness. Everything that would cause sadness is going to be gone. And I believe, looking at this image, the idea of this being heaven fits much better than this just being another phase of the church on earth. Even today, There are some places in the world where Christians are suffering, Christians are being persecuted, Christians are being put to death for their faith. So this idea of all that pain and sorrow being gone doesn't quite fit with just a new stage in the church on earth. In heaven, though, there will be no sadness. It tells us also there'll be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, and no more pain. So again, this is to bring comfort to those who are suffering at that moment in time, those who are being killed for their faith at that moment in time. When we get to heaven, all of that pain is going to be gone. Verse 5, "Then he who sat on the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.' And he said to me, 'Write, for these words are true and faithful.'" In verse 5, John hears the voice of the one who sits on the throne. We know that that is referring to God the Father. He is the one who sits on the throne. And he says, "Behold, I make all things new." Now, if you think of what God has done, he has the power to make all things new. He created the earth and the universe, everything in the universe, just by speaking it. And so he can take that all away, the earth can be burned up, and he can make something new. He has the power to do that. At the end of verse 5, God gives his personal guarantee. He tells John to write, "These words are true and faithful." God cannot tell a lie. God is telling us these words, and these words are true. In verse 6, it says, "And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of water of life freely to him who thirsts.'" So he says, "It is done." This is still God the Father speaking. I believe this identifies that his plan of salvation is done. The judgment day has already happened. The faithful are in heaven. So his plan of salvation is done. The faithful have been redeemed from the earth. They have been brought to heaven. And now they are there in fellowship with God. And that fellowship is going to exist forever. God further identifies himself as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He existed before the world began. He's going to exist after the world ends. He's been forever in the past and in the future. He is eternal. In the last half of verse 6, we have a promise to those who were alive at the time that this letter was written. So this is a promise of what they are seeing in this vision. So John is going to go back and tell these Christians who are suffering, "These things that I see are promised to you. You can have these things, but there is a condition there. They do have to remain faithful." He says, God says, "I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts." Those who thirst have to seek after this. There are going to be things that we have to do that we find in other passages. But those who will do those things are going to be freely given this entrance into heaven to have this water of life. And we're also going to see this promise repeated in Revelation 22 and verse 17. So verse 7 says, "He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." So we have another exhortation to overcome. When we looked at the seven churches of Asia, each one of them was given a promise that he who overcomes will receive various blessings. And they were told different blessings, but they all refer to the same thing, that we all have this promise of going to heaven and being in fellowship with God. The Christians were suffering for their faith. They needed some encouragement to help them to endure through all of this persecution. So verse 7 promises that reward. If they will overcome, they are going to have all these things. They're going to inherit all things, and they are going to have this fellowship with God. Now in verse 8, we're going to see just a contrast. It's talking about all of the faithful. One more reminder of the wicked. Verse 8 says, "But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." So that is a contrast to the picture of heaven. Verse 8 gives one more warning about what's going to happen to sinners. It gives us a list of sins, but this is not an all-inclusive list. The Bible contains lists of sins in several places, and not one of them is an all-inclusive list. So this is a representative list of the types of sins. All of those sins are going to condemn us to eternal punishment. I use this verse a lot to talk about the types of sins, because people want to classify sins into big sins and little sins. And nowhere do we find that in the Bible. And usually they'll take telling a little white lie as one of those little sins. And they'll say, you know, you can do some of those little sins and you don't have to worry about them. You can still go to heaven. Just avoid those big sins. Well, God doesn't look at it that way. And here we see he's included liars as some of those who will be cast into the lake of fire. He says all liars. So that even includes that little white lie. All liars are going to be cast into the lake of fire. So God looks at all sin alike. All sin is going to be punished by being thrown into the lake of fire. Being cast into the lake of fire is called the second death. This was also listed in Revelation 20 and verse 14, where death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. So our physical death is the first death, and this judgment being cast into the lake of fire is the second death. So these first eight verses have shown us this idea that we're going to be in fellowship with God. Now the next set of verses till the end of the chapter is going to describe the protection that God is going to provide for us. So verse 9 says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked to me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. So one of those angels that we've already seen comes and talks to John again. And this was one of those characteristics of apocalyptic language. One of the characters within the vision comes and actually talks to the person who is receiving the vision. The angel told John that he would show him the bride who was the Lamb's wife. And we saw that back in verse 2. I was reading a commentary this afternoon that said the New Jerusalem might be the residence of this bride of Christ. So that would be another indication that the church was in this New Jerusalem, but this New Jerusalem is heaven. All right, looking at verse 10. Verse 10 says, and he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. So the angel carried John away in the spirit. This is just talking about receiving a vision. We've seen this language three other times already in the book. John was taken in a vision to a great and high mountain, and that mountain is going to give him a little better vantage point of what this New Jerusalem looks like. He's seeing it again, but now he's going to see it in greater detail than what he saw back in verse 2. Verse 11 says, having the glory of God, her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. So in verse 11, this great city has the glory of God. We talked about in the Old Testament, the glory of God filled the tabernacle. That was in Exodus 40 and verse 34. Also, the glory of God filled the temple at the time that it was dedicated. That was in 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 1. It tells us here, the light of the city was like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. One commentary said that jasper might have been a diamond, so that would be a very beautiful stone. It was one of the stones that was on the breastplate of the high priest, and it was also used in the description of God back in chapter 4 and verse 3. Verse 12, also she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So the city is described as having great and high walls. This again is the idea of protection. Those who are taken into this city are going to be protected because it has great walls there to protect them from anything on the outside. Actually, those who had been hurting them, persecuting them, killing them, are not going to be able to hurt them anymore because those people have already been cast into the lake of fire. So there's really no one out there outside the city who's going to be able to do them any harm. The city has 12 gates. There is an angel at each one of those gates just to ensure that nothing would come in, but there's really nothing out there that would be able to harm them. The gates have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel written on them. I think all that is showing us is that heaven is going to be there for all of the faithful from the Old Testament. We'll see the New Testament in just a couple of verses, but all of God's faithful from that time of the Old Testament will be in heaven. They will also have this fellowship with God. Verse 13, three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, and three gates on the west. These gates are facing the four corners of the world, north, south, east, and west. I believe this is just showing us that everyone who's been faithful is going to have access to this new city. All of the faithful of God are going to be there in heaven in fellowship with God. Verse 14. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So we saw the 12 tribes of Israel in verse 12. Now we're seeing the 12 apostles. So this city is going to be there for all of the faithful in the New Testament age. And if you put those two together, then we have all of the faithful of God's people are going to be together there in heaven. They're all going to have fellowship with God. They're going to be in this great city. They're going to have the protection of God. Verse 15, and he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. The one who talked with John goes back to verse 9, and that was the angel, one of the angels who had the bowls of wrath. This angel has a golden measuring rod, and he's going to measure the city, the gates, and the wall. And we're going to see just how massive this city is. Verse 16, the city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth, and he measured the city with a reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. So this describes the shape of the city. It describes it first as a two-dimensional space. It's a square. The length and the width are the same, so it's a square. But then it goes on to tell us that the height is also the same. So this would be a perfect cube. Had one commentary say it might be a pyramid, so it's as tall as it is wide. But either way, this is going to be a very large, very massive structure. We're only given one dimension, and it says that it's 12,000 furlongs. There are 8 furlongs in a mile, so this is going to be 1,500 miles. So if you imagine how far that is a long ways. Now, Heath mentioned in class this afternoon that would be from New Orleans to Bismarck, North Dakota. I also looked up at the map to see where it would be from Dayton. If you went from Dayton, you would go all the way to Salt Lake City, Utah. And actually, you would have to go about 40 miles past that to get 1,500 miles. So you can see, we're talking about a massive city. Now, as we look at this, we realize these numbers are symbolic. It's not really a measurement. 12 represents the people of God. 10 is a complete number, a perfect number, and 1,000 is a multiple of 10. And you take those two together, we see that this city is going to be big enough for all of God's people. All of the faithful are going to be able to fit in this city and be in fellowship with God. Verse 17, then he measured its wall, 144 cubits according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. This gives another measurement, and I believe it's talking about the thickness of the wall. A cubit is the length of a man's forearm. We generally think of that as being 18 inches. I was looking at this as how long is the forearm of an angel, but one of the commentaries said that this means it's the forearm of a man measured by an angel. But either way, when this works out, if it's 18 inches, that's 216 feet thick. So you could do a lot of protecting with 216 feet of wall. So again, looking at the idea God is protecting his people, this wall is very thick. And again, the numbers are symbolic. 12 is the people of God. 144 is 12 times 12. So again, it's looking at all of the people of God, and they are all going to be protected in this city. Verse 18, the construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass. So this gives us a little more of the description of heaven. Heaven is a spiritual place, so this is figurative. There's no way really that you could describe a spiritual place in terms that we would understand. So we're looking at an image, looking at figurative things in terms of things that we would understand. We understand diamonds, so if this is like a jasper, it's like diamonds. And if it's pure gold, we understand what gold looks like. This gold is a little bit different, though, because it's transparent. It's as clear as glass. So this obviously is figurative language. Verse 19. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th, amethyst. So we see 12 different kinds of precious stones. Again, 12 is the number of the people of God. And what we want to get from this is just the beauty of all of these different kinds of precious stones. Heaven is going to be a very beautiful place. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. So here in verse 21, the 12 gates were each made of a single pearl. I looked at one commentary that said pearls were considered to be the most precious of these precious jewels. It was given the highest rank of all these precious jewels. So that is telling us how beautiful these gates are going to be, how beautiful heaven is going to be. The streets of the city are made of pure gold. And again, this gold is this transparent glass-like gold. So again, going to be very beautiful. Verse 22, but I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. In verse 22, we're told that there is no temple in this New Jerusalem. Now, as we've gone through several of the chapters before this, we've seen a temple in heaven. We've seen that in chapter 11, chapter 14, chapter 15, and chapter 16. But here in this New Jerusalem, there's not going to be a temple. But if you think about it, the temple was the place that God came to dwell, to be with his people. And this New Jerusalem is the place where God will dwell with his people. The whole city is going to be that place where he comes to dwell with his people. So there's no need for there to be a temple in this new city. The whole city will be the dwelling place of God. Verse 23, the city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. In this new Jerusalem, there's not going to be any need for the sun or the moon. Those are the heavenly bodies that give light to us here on earth. But in heaven, God is going to be the light. God is going to be the only light that we need, and Jesus will be there as well to give light as well. Verse 24. And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Verse 24 lets us know that the saved are the ones who are going to be in heaven. They are the ones who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. We saw that in Revelation 5 and verse 9. We'll see again in verse 27, it's only those whose name is found written in the book of life. This says that there will be nations there. We saw the 144,000 were all Jews. This is telling us that there's going to be more than just that 144,000 there in heaven. There's going to be the Gentile nations as well. It talks about some of the kings of the earth will be there to bring glory. I don't believe this is talking about their own personal glory and honor, but as they do the commandments of God, they will glorify and give honor to God. There were men like King David, King Hezekiah, King Josiah that were good kings, and they brought honor to God by doing the things that God had told them to do. Verse 25, its gates shall not be shut at all by day, there shall be no night there. So the gates of heaven will never be shut, and there's no need to shut the gates. All of those people that are going to be kept out of heaven have already been cast into the lake of fire. So there's no way for them to get to heaven. If they could, there's an angel guarding that gate anyway. The angel would make sure they can't get in. So again, we're talking about protection. There's no danger that they need to be protected from. The city is going to be so massive that they will have total protection being inside this city. It says there'll be no night in heaven because God is its light. Contrast that to the judgment scene of Matthew 25 and verse 30. It says the wicked will be cast into outer darkness. So in heaven, there's going to be light. In hell, it will be outer darkness. Verse 26, and they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. So all those who have been faithful have done what God has commanded to do. They are going to be giving honor and glory to God by the things that they have done. They're going to bring honor and glory into heaven because they have been faithful. Back in Revelation 14 and verse 13, it said, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. And then it says, their works follow them. That's how this glory is going to be brought into heaven. It's their works that they have done. And verse 27, but there shall by no means enter into it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. There will be no sin in heaven. There will be nothing that defiles. There will be nothing that brings an abomination. There will be no lies. Back in verse 5, John was told, these words are true and faithful. So there will be no lies in heaven. In Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14, Jesus told us that we must make a choice between two roads that we will follow in this life. One is the narrow road that's going to lead to heaven, and the broad way that's going to lead to destruction. So all of those on the narrow way will have their name written in the Lamb's book of life. Those that travel down the broad way that is full of sin, those are not going to make it to heaven. Only those whose name is written in the book of life are going to make it into heaven. So we've seen in these verses that heaven is going to be a very beautiful place. We are going to have fellowship with God, in direct fellowship with God, and we are going to have the protection that God gives us being in this great, massive, walled city. These words are meant to give comfort to those who were suffering. Christians were being persecuted. Some of them were being killed because of their faith. So here we see a description of something that is going to be great, something that's going to be wonderful, something that's going to make it all worthwhile going through all of that suffering and pain and even death. If you think of the martyrs of the first century, you often wonder how they could go through all of those terrible things that they had to endure. Some of them were covered with tar and lit on fire as a torch. You think of how could they do that? Well, they could do that because they knew that this great reward was waiting for them. And that's how they could make that. All right, we've got just a minute or two left, so we'll open it up for comments. Yeah, there's nothing like that to really describe that, except what we're seeing right here, that there is going to be no more sorrow. I know a lot of people wonder, well, you know, what's it going to be like if I know that my father or mother died and they were never baptized, you know, and they're not going to be there, am I going to be sad? Well, I think being in the presence of God is going to be so overwhelming that none of that is going to matter to us. Heath, you had your hand up.
Yes, verse 8, where we have the list of sins, and you say it's not an all-inclusive list, but the first sin that's mentioned is the cowardly, and we certainly wouldn't put them alongside the murderers and the sorcerers
No.
and all that. But remember, the book is written to Christians, encouraging them to remain Sure. faithful. If they give in to the pressure of Rome and they call Caesar Lord, they're giving in out of cowardice.
Right.
And notice, they're the first ones on the list who are not going to enter into this New Jerusalem. And so it's
Right.
significant that cowards are mentioned first in that list.
That cowardly would be very relevant to their situation. Yes. All right. Chapter 22.